Oyez, the Honorable Court of Appeals for the Third District of the State of Texas, sitting in Austin, is now in session.
Good morning, y'all can be seated, thank you very much. Welcome to the Third Court of Appeals. Justice Kelly and I all welcome you here today, and Justice Ellis as well, so it's a pleasure to have you all. This is cause number 0323209, CV Jones and Free Speech Systems versus Heslin and Lewis. That is the case that sets for trial today. If I could have counsels introduce themselves for the court record.
Ryan Dean Brooks, my colleague, Isabel.
Thank you.
Mark Manson for the appellate.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure. As you know, this matter is being recorded via Zoom, and it's presently live. So, and it will be on our Third Court of Appeals website and available to you for viewing later. As you know, each side has 20 minutes, and my understanding is that the appellants will open with 15 minutes and close with 5, and then, of course, the appellees will have their full 20. In preparation for the argument today, the court has reviewed the appellant's brief, the appellee brief. We have received the reply brief. Some of that has been reviewed, some not, at least on my behalf, because of its size. Motion to strike and sanctions and objections to exhibits, and we did receive exhibits. Just to kind of place where the court is on these things today, the court is going to carry the motion to strike and objections to the merits of this case. So if you choose to argue about things that are in things that are being objected to during your 20 minutes aside, it may or may not be beneficial to you. I can't tell you one way or the other because we're going to carry that to the conclusion of this case. I will tell you that based on just my very quick review of the items asserted, and as I kind of channel my prior colleague, Judge John Dietz, as each side knows, I was on the trial court bench for 20 years, so I dealt with numerous of the judges that are referenced in your record, including Judge Jenkins. And as it relates to Judge John Dietz, when I see an appellate's brief that is 113 pages, 77 of which is briefing, and I see an appellee's brief that is responsive to that and about the 70 arena, and then I get a reply brief filed a couple of weeks before now, and it's 620 pages. As Judge John Dietz used to say when he had motions for summary judgment, very different standard, motions for summary judgment, where there were very large summary judgment motions, because there's going to be the weight of the evidence is likely that there is a fact issue in there somewhere. So I just want you to know that I saw a motion to strike and I saw 620 pages of a reply brief and a request for sanctions nonetheless. I've been on this bench now 4.5 years. I've not seen a sanctions motion at this level ever. So that's unique and concerning for me. And even in the trial court, very, very few sanctions orders ever requested. So I just want to lay that out as you consider how you spend your 20 minutes, because there are some really important issues that are raised both in the appellant's brief and the appellee's brief alone without ever touching the reply brief. So just for your consideration. So with that, I am going to turn the dais over to Mr. Brooks. Yes, sir.
Thank you very much. And sure. Ben Brooks. And so the Judge Jenkins, the names you called are people we're all very familiar with. I went to college with Judge Jenkins, you know, so of all things. I was in this court arguing the Warner Brothers versus Jones case. So we're very familiar with First Amendment issues, IED defamation claims. And I want to, so we're very familiar with the law on this. And we did the reply brief. Someone else did the appellate's opening brief. But I want to say this about the 600 pages. This court has three independent reviews it must conduct. Three. They're independent of one another. They interrelate. One is a duty of constitutional analysis. You must do that. That is commanded by the United States Supreme Court repeatedly and the Texas Supreme Court. It is inescapable. And to assist you in doing that, the requirement is you must look. You, as a court, must look at the broadcasts. You can't look at snippets or what people say about the broadcasts. You have to examine them in their entirety and in their context. Those videos, we have bent over backwards to make sure that they are in your record, but they're videos, and that's hard for a court to look at. So the 600 pages, the vast, well, all but 25 pages of that, are transcripts. We transcribed them to help you so that you didn't have to sit there and watch videos. So that's when the appellants say, or appellees say 600 pages, that's a little bit misleading. We took the videos that are already in evidence, and we transcribed them to assist the court in the review that you must do. You're ordered to do it by the United States and Texas Supreme Court. Now, the beauty of these, and you can choose to look at our transcripts or not, it just makes it a lot simpler. And you will note when you look at those on Appendix A, and I'll tell you A and B in a moment, there's a little blue hyperlink. And that means when you're looking at the transcript and it says something, you can click the hyperlink. I tried it again last night. You can actually watch the video. It takes you right to the section. So again, our effort is to simply help you, the court, in conducting its analysis. We want to try to assist you in any way that we can. And so that's the first analysis. The first review you must do is a constitutional review. And that constitutional review requires you all to look at the transcripts to determine what is the context of each alleged statement? Was it false? Is there evidence of malice? And is that evidence clear and convincing? And is it an opinion? Now these are reviews you must do. And so the appellee's argument is, well, you didn't have to do that because the default judgment precluded that. We argue you can't have a default judgment that supersedes the United States Constitution. Not where you have a media defendant, Mr. Alex Jones, a public controversy, which this clearly was, and public figures. This whole the defamation portion of it starts with Neil Heston going on a live internationally broadcast program, the Megyn Kelly Show, 5 years after the fact, making statements, criticizing as a part of the program the accuracy of Mr. Jones's reporting, when the statements that they claim were defamatory are simply pointing out their own inconsistencies,
dramatizations. So is it your position that the constitutional protected speech survives the default judgment?
Yes, absolutely. It supersedes the default judgment. In fact, the default judgment, our position is it can't be rendered, and I'll tell you why. The Supreme Court says, for example, that, in fact, I've got my demonstratives here. This quote is just everywhere. It's the first page, is the Sullivan case. It says, the First Amendment guarantees, which include freedom of the press, have consistently refused to recognize any exception for truth, whether administered by judges, juries, or administrative officials. How much more the elimination of these burdens? I mean, if it doesn't accept any exception, the elimination can't be contemplated.
And was that argued in your opening brief in pages 28 to 39, which is the only place in your brief where you're talking about the constitutionality issues?
Well, Your Honor, we're going to respond to his motion to strike and the allegations because it just, as you pointed out, it just takes too much time to do that. But you said page 28, did you just say?
It's pages 28 to 39 opening brief.
I think it's more than that. You can do simple word searches and find out, type in the word constitution.
Oh, I read them all this morning.
Okay.
It's in pages 28 to 39.
And so, and I think that again, I don't want to waste my time arguing about this motion to strike, but I think when we read the Supreme Court of Bertucci, you know, it is the Supreme Court is very concerned about making sure the cases get tried on the merits. Not become some technical, you know. Now this whole argument.
If they are tried on the merits, doesn't that require full and complete discovery, including four additional depositions that were allegedly never done, and at least one set of full written discovery that was never responded to, which was the basis of the default, which is the reason you didn't get to some of the liability aspects?
Well, the response is, we have tried to our best to supplement the record when it was pointed out by the appellees that there were some things missing. We did our very best to give the court everything that we could find and everything that they said was missing so that you would have that information in your files. So the presence of those documents, we believe, whatever the records are, we gave it to the court, and you had most of them, and we tried to give everything that they said was missing. So the point is that, but I think that the question, because I've obviously spent some time interrupting my preparation to look at this.
Sure, of course.
And the point is that you know, you don't, there's lots of cases out there where the question of what was properly raised in an opening brief is contested. I think the Supreme Court has put that to rest. Is as long as the issue
in what case? In what case? Are you talking about the U.S. Supreme Court or the Texas Supreme Court?
I'm talking about the Texas Supreme Court in March of this year when they issued the overruling this court in Bank. When this court came back and said that issues weren't properly raised, they were raised in a reply brief that weren't properly in the opening. The very issue here on multiple occasions, Supreme Court said no. They were conceptually raised. The issues were joined. And in fact, the Constitution, if you go back to the appellee's brief, they fully understood the constitutional arguments being made. They addressed them. So it wasn't like they were surprised. They didn't say they were surprised. They didn't say they were prejudiced. But the constitutional review, to answer your question, Your Honor, yes, it absolutely supersedes the, in fact, think of it this way. Think of it, this is, because I'm struggling, I knew someone would ask me that question. I wanted to put it to you this way. Suppose there's a small rural town in Mississippi. I hate to use that state, but southern state. And the NAACP decides that merchants there are discriminating. And so they tell the people their discrimination, we're going to have a boycott. Well, the merchants sue, defamation. Small little provincial town, elected official, the NAACP is organized, swamped with discovery. The judge defaults them and says, now the NAACP default judgment, every asset you have is now available to your enemies that you sued to seize, and they now own the name. Now, no one would ever contend, and that there's a Supreme Court case that's very closely on point. No one could contend the Constitution is eliminated in that context. The Constitution is required in that context. It is required. That's what the judges, your job is to make sure that the record contains the constitutional requisite facts that are necessary. And the default judgment, a state court judge cannot on her own decide, right or wrong, that a media defendant on a public controversy with public figures who are injecting themselves into the controversy, that she can decide that the death penalty and the defendant here has found judicially decreed to be liable, maliciously liable, for a defamation that on its face of the pleading is false.
You can so, counsel, yes, ma'am. You are arguing that, let's imagine, and this is not the fact situation here, but let's imagine the same lawsuit was here, and your client did not one response to one order to compel, not one response to any depositions, not one response to any discovery. You are telling me that the trial court's hands are tied and she or he cannot render a death penalty sanction, even staring down the face of a defendant that is thumbing their nose at court orders and discovery.
Yes, but I want to say yes, that didn't happen here. But,
yeah, but
yes,
if it did,
I'm going to respond to that. But I don't. But I want to quibble with you a little bit on your hands. The judge's
then
hands.
And where's the rule of law on that?
So well, they haven't cited a case that says that the Constitution is superseded by administrative penalties. I've cited several cases and can cite you more where it says, for example, that this in your constitutional review you give no deference to the trial court. Now how can you say that? And that's the Supreme Court in the Hurley case. It says
case involve a situation that is involving egregious discovery violations?
Well, no, but Your Honor, the axiom and the principle remains unrefuted that a trial court's judgments are not given any deference in your analysis. Now, let's go back to this.
There so trial three, court's hands are tied.
No,
they have nothing that they can do.
I
they
did
can.
Not say that.
But what
say
can
that.
They do?
Well,
tell
I
me.
I want to tell you, but first of all, the question is they cannot. What they cannot do is issue a death penalty sanction. Now, what they the whole panoply of remedies is available. Financial, you could order computers to be seized and searched. You could send a receiver in if you don't think the discovery is being conducted. The judge has plenty of powers. What she cannot do is decree that a statement that is clearly true is false, that the plaintiff is excused of all its burdens of proof, that I'm going to find malice as a matter of law, because of what I believe to be discovered indiscretions. Now, I want to address that because I think that's a misstatement in the record here. There were three different cases that were filed. Three. Two of them were consolidated, and then defaults entered, and then the Lewis case, default was entered later, then consolidated later. So it's a little bit of a mishmash to try to scramble the egg right now and look at everything. Let's take it one at a time.
Before we do that, yes. I mean, the $45 million looming question in this case is the cap buster. Let's imagine, Mr. Brooks, we've got 20 minutes. Let's imagine that I disagree with you and this panel disagrees with you on the default. Let's just imagine that. I know that that's not a thing that you agree with, but let's just imagine that.
I can't see my time here.
Okay. Oh, certainly, of course. Sure.
Okay.
The two big issues, the two elephants in the room, is the default and the cap buster. $45 million here, and maybe I believe you on default, maybe I don't. But tell me about your position on the cap buster and the post-trial amendment in your client's position there and how respond.
I'll tell you, first of all, the Ratamco case, the Supreme Court said in Ratamco that where you can't have punitive damages in the context of a default judgment. They cite the Goldberg case, which is a Supreme Court case, but that's what it says. The Supreme Court of Texas says that, citing the Supreme Court of America. And it makes sense, because if you read Chapter 41, everything in Chapter 41 contemplates that the trier of fact is finding liability issues. 41.111 says that the jury must consider the nature of the wrong, the character of the conduct involved. That was all taken away here. All of that was, the judge said, you don't have to do that.
But aren't you arguing also in your opening brief that no, in fact, that was argued in the compensatory end, and you guys didn't like that, that they were arguing about all the bad acts of your client, allegedly, and the compensatory thing, and you objected because they were supposedly not allowed to make those arguments in the compensatory phase of the case.
It was a confusing time, because the default judgment, the jury was instructed multiple times that there will be no contest of liability. They were instructed about that in the punitive damages. I'm instructing you that you don't have to consider these things. So there was a lot of back and forth, maybe confusion even, as to what should and shouldn't be argued. Because, and I think they did it at the same time that my predecessors did. There was moving positions back and forth. But the statute doesn't change. The statute says that the jury, the fact finder, must consider these things, and at 4011, and they couldn't. They not only did they not get a chance to consider it, they were instructed on them, and then after the fact, the jury renders its damages, I think it's punitive damages, on, I think, August the 8th, I believe it was. Months later, they filed an amendment to say, hey, we want to claim that the cap buster, that these people were disabled. Disabled.
Mr. Brooks.
Yes.
Had they amended prior to trial, and you still had the default judgment, whether it was right or wrong, what should have happened then at this trial with that piece, with the disabled piece? What's your view?
Yeah. Well, that's first of all, the jury should have decided that.
Okay. So questions to the jury.
Yeah,
on
that should have been a fact question.
And what's the standard for that fact question for the jury?
What do you mean, what the standard
what was,
is?
What should they be instructed? What's the burden of proof that they should have been instructed? Clear and convincing.
Clear and convincing evidence. And that's another thing.
Now, in your opening brief, you talk about it being beyond a reasonable doubt. Is it clear and convincing or beyond a reasonable doubt?
I think it's clear and convincing.
Okay. All right.
I think it's
okay.
Clear and convincing. I think the cap buster penal is a different question now.
That's what I'm asking about.
Yeah,
I'm asking about the cap buster penal.
Is probably beyond a reasonable doubt. You can't, but the rest of the punitive damages must be decided by clear and convincing evidence. And that was, the instruction was preponderance of the evidence.
Okay, I don't understand.
All right, let me see. So
clear and convincing is on all the exemplary damages.
Yes.
But if you take her question, all right, the penal code was in there before the default. Let's say it
if
was,
it were, right.
and it wasn't, we know that, but let's say it was, the difference would be in that verdict form. On that aspect, it would be beyond a reasonable
That's
doubt.
What I believe.
Okay, all right, thank
now,
you.
Now, the other thing is that Chapter 41 itself is replete with the fact finder must determine, and the opinion that you're supposed to give. That's the third review. The first review was a constitutional review. The second review, you're required to review the default, exactly, the whole record for the default to see whether it was just, whether it was justified, whether it was in keep, whether the crimes fit the punishment, whether or not...
Did you preserve clear and convincing? Is there an objection to the charge? Is there objection to anything about the proper burden of proof in the record?
Your Honor, there is. And what happened is I read the record. As I read the record, Her Honor is reading the charge to the jury, and she reads the words preponderance. And the trial counsel jumped up and said, Your Honor, wait a minute, I object. And I think she said, no, you've waited too long. You've waived that.
It wasn't in the charge conference?
I don't believe it was in the charge conference. I believe he made that objection as she's reading it to the jury. It's my
recollection. And you didn't tender a proper description of what the charge should say, and there's no written order from the judge in this record rejecting or accepting that request by your client?
I don't believe he submitted a written request, and I'm quite certain I didn't see a written overruling that, but he did it verbally, and he told her what it should say. He said, it's just three words. Preponderance of the four to changing three for four.
But doesn't that typically occur in the charge conference with
proper documentation? It typically
occurs
in the charge conference. But that's not the question. The question is it a waiver? Is it some sort of a relinquishment of a known right when right there it could be rectified? It could have been. It would have been awkward? Yes, of course it would have been awkward. Would it have been better? Of course it would have been better. But it was made. And the judge, the whole point of this, of these exercises, is so that the trial court can see at the trial an error and correct it. That's the point.
And your time is up, so let me let you get whatever your ending thought in this part of your time.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. So my ending point is this, is that I think that the country is very concerned about inaccurate news. And the way you solve that problem is not by intimidating the press from reporting controversial matters. One immigrant, commits a murder and the entire immigrant community is labeled as criminals. That's not right. And for journalists to do the hard work to defend and say, look, this is not right. You can't take one immigrant's act and blame it. That's the same thing that happened here. Mr. Jones is defending journalists, and that's what's under attack, his right to freedom of the press.
Thank you, Mr. Brooks.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Mr. Bankston.
May it please the court. I've had so many cases with this court and very few opportunities to come here and speak to you. And normally I would be extraordinarily excited and honored to come speak to you about a case where the issues presented by the brief are weighty and have huge impact and all of those things. Unfortunately, that is not this case. The appeal before you, I believe, is a rather dry procedural appeal if you look at the actual issues in the opening brief. And so I want to talk... We obviously didn't talk about most of the 7 points of error raised in the opening brief. So I will confine my discussion, I think, to the issues that I do believe you think are important, which I do too, which is the default judgment and the cap-busting allegations. I do want to mention, though, really quickly, to address, Justice Byrne, your comments about the request for sanctions at this level in the Court of Appeals being unique. And I hesitate to correct you on this, but it's not unique, not even in this case. These appellants have been sanctioned by this court for frivolous litigation conduct in this case. That occurred in 2020. And in that sanction, when that happened, those sanctions were issued. And part of the deterrent effect of those sanctions were to not do two things that they did in that appeal, which is one, is to not brief issues that were not before the court. And two, do not make false statements of material fact. The court was, in my opinion, very correct to issue those sanctions. And now confronted with the exact same thing, I believe I would be absolutely derelict in not asking you again to do the same thing.
Mr. Banks, may I ask you a quick question? How do you respond to Mr. Brooks' statement that the constitutional issues supersede the default judgment?
That was actually the next place I was going, so thank you, Your Honor. I think one of the important things that Justice Byrne brought up is what happens if the merits discovery upon which these issues are required to be proved is not provided. For instance, one of the constitutional tests that you would have to do in defamation is determine whether not just the text of the statement, but the entire context of where the statement was given, how it was given, the facts surrounding the statement, whether those would make it a factor in opinion. Well, we were denied any discovery into the entire context of the statements.
Now, right? They would say they gave you 80,000 pages.
So and I would say that the number of pages is absolutely meaningless. As you will see in the briefing at the trial court, the vast, and I mean vast, overwhelming majority of those pages were pages by a man named Wolfgang Haubig, were unsolicited emails that he sent to InfoWars. Nearly 70,000 pages, because he would send pages with 500,000 pages of attachments of this crazy stuff about the parents being actors, right? So the vast, vast overwhelming majority of that material was purely just related to Wolfgang Haubitz's emails. A large majority of the other material we demonstrated was non-responsive. The important part is that we got obviously no emails from Jones, despite showing at trial that he does in fact possess email and have emails on these things. The record of the discovery abuse in the case is so voluminous it's impossible to entirely brief it to you. Even back during the TCPA appeals, this court pointed out the giant heft of the amount of sanctions materials that were before it.
Mr. Brooks is saying the Constitution trumps that and the death penalty cannot be imposed even if you got not one scrap of paper nor one deposition. How do you respond to that?
I would say that I find that categorically perverse. I think if a defendant like Jones can say, aha, I can escape liability by denying you all the discovery you would need to prove your constitutional issues, right? I can do that and then skip out of court. You have now encouraged the defiance of the court that we are here to prevent. And I'll give you a really good example of this, is that they have told you, we've given you all the transcripts so you can look at the videos and decide whether they meet the standards for IED and defamation. You haven't been given all the videos. We know that. There's trial transcripts on this. We have a very small amount of what Jones actually did over these years. And that was further borne out by what happened up in the Connecticut trial, which is why in the next case, Posner, before we ever have a trial on that, we're going to have to go back to the court and say, hey, we got to clear up some even bigger messes in discovery than we thought. So you don't even, the things that the plaintiff sued on, the allegations that were made, that they were entitled to have discovery on, you don't have all of that in front of you, and you never will.
And yeah, I'm looking at your brief, page 4 and 5, you make a list of a variety of things that allegedly, you know, in order to analyze the default aspects and the breadth of it, you would need transcripts from hearings. Were those ever supplemented, like the April 3rd transcript, the December 18th transcript? Did the appellants ever provide that or the orders that are reflected in your page 4 and 5?
It appears that some of that has been provided, right? I don't want to represent to you that everything has been provided, because I know there are things that happened.
Okay.
Right? And in particular, much of the evidence that plaintiff moved on in order to put this before you, that briefing is not before the court. And some of this resulted from the fact that there were 3 cause numbers at one point. And when putting the appeal together, the appellants really didn't get everything they needed to get. Now, I do think it is a little strange that they would make an argument based on an incomplete record. I would respond to that argument, point out that it was deficient, and then they would do a redo on reply to try to get all of this before you. I do not believe you have everything in front of you that you would need to do a normal review of death penalty sanctions. That being said, I do think that what is before you is plainly sufficient to support the court's orders. As you pointed out, not only do we have multiple depositions missing, we have discovery that wasn't answered, that has been falsely asserted to this court that it was answered, and it has not been. Right? And it's not just one set of discovery. There were 3 different TCPA courses of discovery, and then that once we returned from remand that the court wanted answered. Right? We have some answers on some that were sanctioned and found to be deficient, and on others we have no answers whatsoever.
Do you mind if I ask a question about moving to the cap busting?
Sure.
Can you explain how severe emotional disturbance constitutes a disability for
sure.
cap busting purposes?
That's actually in if you notice, if there's a section in the penal code which defines disability, mm-hmm. and one of those is a severe emotional disturbance. And severe emotional disturbance would be the kind of emotional disturbance that could be compensable, right? That would, in other words, this court will not approve of compensation for emotional distress that didn't interfere with the plaintiff's life in any way, right? If it's an upset that didn't actually cause compensable damages, that's not even compensable. So the parties all sort of agreed at trial, right, that the plaintiffs had suffered severe emotional disturbance before Jones ever said anything. And in fact, it was defendant's argument at trial that that was the true basis of their damages, not Jones at all. The plaintiff's argument was they had the severe emotional disturbance and it was aggravated by Jones. Both parties completely agreed on the existence of the pre-existing emotional disturbance and had throughout the case.
Now, Mr. Bankston, kind of hearkening back to Justice Kelly's question to Mr. Brooks, had the plaintiffs asserted the penal code, you know, say before the default, don't you think strategically the defendant might go, oh my goodness, they've pled a cat buster. $750,000 in punitives are no longer the limitation. The sky is the limit now. Maybe we might want to scour our documents and really get into this case and provide discovery and avoid this default, abide by court orders, and produce documentation so that they actually get to try their case fully on the merits at trial, as opposed to getting this amendment 2 months after a verdict, wherein your brief argues that because of the default that occurred before they even knew you pled this, that they've agreed that it's a disabled person, pretty much. I mean, which is odd to me to twist my mind around that argument.
I have two responses to that. The first is, I can follow the logic of a defendant who says, now that this case is worth more money, I'm going to follow the rules. I think that also is a dangerous construction of the law, to say that we are conditioning saying that, well, yes, the defendant willfully thumbed its nose at the court, but if it had been worth more money, maybe it wouldn't have, right? In other words, that your compliance with the rules is somehow conditional among the amount of controversy involved. And I think that sets a really bad precedent, right? To say that, well, this defendant should have essentially had another bite at the apple, because if it would have had more money, it would have acted right. And so therefore its wrong conduct can kind of like not cover this. But more importantly, I think, is that I do not think that you need the default in order to reach the conclusion that jury findings were not required here. And that is because both parties tried this by consent and made these arguments. The argument that the plaintiffs were suffering from pre-existing emotional disturbance was the cornerstone of defendant's case.
And what in the evidence in the, I guess, the consequential damages part, because that's where all the bad acts were kind of talked about, did you talk about the issue of their inability to perform daily activities, you know, go to school, go to sleep? Did any of that, I mean, I saw the quotes in your brief, mm-hmm. but none of those dealt with, you know, I can't get out of bed in the morning, I can't sleep at night. If I had other children, I can't care for them, I can't get them to school. Is that anywhere in there? Because that's an element of
Well, what you'll see is that's certainly discussed about in terms of the conduct that Jones did and how that affected them. Scarlett Lewis not being able to sleep without a gun under her pillow, those sorts of things, right? Now, in terms of what their condition was beforehand, we had medical testimony from expert psychologists saying that they were suffering from PTSD, mm-hmm. that these people at this time were in a severe emotional disturbance state, right? And the defendants also solicited that same testimony. Right, that the death of your child affected you in such profound ways as to make you severely emotionally disturbed. Right, and so not only was there testimony coming out from the plaintiffs about this, but this was, like I say, the cornerstone of their defense. And so the defendants can't really be prejudiced by saying that there should have been a jury finding for a proposition of fact that they were affirmatively telling the jury existed. Right, that would be conflicting with what their actual trial evidence and strategy was. For them to say it would have been error for the jury to find exactly what we were telling them was the situation that existed. And so for that reason, there's no surprise or prejudice to the amendment. And that's the real question before you, is not any of the effects of what happens after the amendment, but the point of error that's raised with you is, was the court in error in granting the amendment itself? And that's a discretionary issue.
Well, Mr. Bankston, I know you cited Greenhall for that concept, but the other part of Greenhall, it says, Greenhall's amendment raised no new substantive matters, and because there was no, you know, showing of surprise or prejudice, and in Greenhall, it was just $100,000 judgment versus $128,000 judgment. There's no cap buster. So how are all of these new elements, if you will, that need to be proven for a cap buster, how is that not a new or substantive matter under Greenhall?
Again, I would point back that it raises no new issue that the defendants were not already affirmatively arguing. Right? The parties were in agreement about the plaintiff's pre-existing emotional disturbance. So when Greenhall talks about the injection of new substantive issues, they mean new issues that they would have to conduct discovery on, that they would have to prepare for trial and create and fashion an argument for. That had already occurred. There is nothing, when Greenhall talks about a new and substantive issue, it's because of the surprise and prejudice it would propose to the defendant in that case. Here, no such surprise or prejudice exists. So there's no real new substantive issue here. And because those issues were both tried by consent at trial, had been the entire feature of defendant's defense through the plaintiff's depositions and up to the time of trial, there's no way for the defendants to demonstrate that they were prejudiced by it. Nor would there be any prejudice because their jury asked for what they asked for the punitive damages. Their trial strategy wouldn't have changed. So between those two things, there's no surprise or prejudice on the cap busting allegation.
And asking you the same question I asked Mr. Brooks, had this been amended prior to trial with with the default judgment, what issues, if any, should have gone to the jury, and what's the standard of proof for those issues?
Well, so my feeling is that if it happened before the default, right, then the default would subsume all of this and all of the things necessary to prove the cap busting would be established by the default.
So following with that, then what's your response to Mr. Brooks on TAMPCO that you can't have a punitives award with the default judgment?
I'm not following that argument, to be honest with you. That seems to shift from a question of when the amendment can be allowed to simply no liability for punitive damages cannot be established by default, and I don't believe that's the correct proposition of law. Certainly, the jury needed to still find the amount of default, but if the effect of the default judgment in the defamation case was to establish that actual malice had occurred, then it obviously follows that default creates liability for exemplary damages as well. Because if you've said now that the defendant's conduct during the case is essentially an admission of actual malice, then what finding would I possibly need to establish liability for punitive damages, right? That's where I'm not following that argument.
Okay, and then on the burden of proof, where do you sit on?
So the burden of proof issue is really interesting because this is the whole thing about what the jury instruction said in the actual trial. And you'll notice that the charge conference is off the record in this case. And then we come back on the record and the judge reflects there were no objections. The appellants were asked point blank, here is the charge, we've read it. Do you have any objections? No. Do you have any objections? No. And Judge Garrett Gamble says wonderful. And the reason she says wonderful is because if parties had objections, it would have been necessary then to put them on the record and have a whole conference on the record and do that. It wasn't, and then the charge gets starting being read to the jury. You cannot at that point, after having told the court you have no objections, and now the jury is being instructed, suddenly stop and give them different instructions.
Well,
the confusion there would be...
Well, at that point, there was no one knew of this cap busting allegations, so...
Sure, okay, I missed in for the finding on exemplary damages and the amounts and all of that thing was that,
right.
You're right,
I'm
the cap
about
busting
hypothetically,
is different.
Had
correct,
it been
and
amended.
I don't think it matters what the standard is for the cap busting, because the cap busting, there was no dispute as to it, right? No party in the case disputed that the parents were suffering from severe emotional disturbance. It was defendant's primary argument. So there is no... Whether you do it through the default, which is an admission, and then therefore would have the effect of a conclusive finding, which would trump any standard of burden of proof. It would be beyond reasonable doubt. But secondly, is that there was no dispute of, this was not a disputed issue during the trial. It would be very difficult for defendants to say they could not meet whatever burden of proof it was to say that they were severely emotionally disturbed when it was defendant who was telling the jury that the parents were severely emotionally disturbed before Jones ever entered their life.
So the penal code and the family code all have very specific elements, right, to for what meets these different levels. It's not just emotional disturbance. It's defined. Do you think there's any distinction between acknowledging that the parents have suffered a loss, and yes, you've ticked off all these other statutory elements that are required to reach this cat buster?
Well, for the disturbance part, the only really required elements would be that the nature of the disturbance itself would be of that type which would be compensable, i.e. that it interferes with their daily functions and that it has some sort of effect on their lives. Because that's exactly what defendants argue, is that this wasn't a matter of saying you had some slight annoyance over the death of your child, you had some slight bit of grief. This was the things that you are saying here in trial that are your life now, the effects that this has had on you, is due to that, not due to Mr. Jones. Is that you had this disturbance that is the source of the compensable damages that you are claiming. So all these things that you're saying, all this testimony you have about how this has affected your life, all of that is a result of the death of your child, not Mr. Jones. So there you have where defendants have now affirmatively argued the elements that would be necessary to show that these people are disabled. In other words, this goes back to the idea that this was the entire foundation of the case since the beginning. All parties agreed that this was the fundamental dispute over damages, whether this was purely the state that the parents were displaying in that courtroom was a result of the death of their children 10 years ago, or whether it was the result of something Mr. Jones did that aggravated that pre-existing condition. Because that's the other thing, the plaintiffs did not try to rebut the defendant's assertion that they were suffering from severe emotional disturbance before Mr. Jones entered their lives. In fact, they endorsed that, as did their expert witnesses. So again, in this case, it comes back to the issue of if that is the case, then how in any case are the defendants prejudiced by having the jury find something that they themselves have urged from the very get-go? So with that said, Your Honor, again, I return to this idea that I would love to be here before you on a case that matters. And the reason I say this is, as I'm certain you probably are aware at this point, there's over $1 billion of non-dischargeable debt against Jones, approved by the Connecticut Supreme Court, that's co-owned by my plaintiffs, that are all collecting together with 19 other family members, right? And now we have an appellant who is trying to remove $50 million. For what purpose? When there's already over $1 billion in dischargeable debt that's coming in part to my plaintiffs, right? What is accomplished by this appeal? And I would submit to you that the only thing that is being accomplished in this appeal is that another new attorney from Jones is being paid more money to perform more legal work that will not go to the parents. The result of this court's decision, I hate to say, is pretty worthless in terms of what's going to happen to the parties. Now, it may have a lot of worth to Texas law. There are some interesting
issues. Counsel, you'll need to wrap up.
Thank you, Your Honor. There are some very interesting issues here that I think can be, that are from an academic standpoint, are things that may have effect on future law. But what is really most troubling to me here is that nothing's being accomplished from this appeal other than decreasing the recovery that these parents will eventually receive. For that reason, to conclude, I would re-urge our motion for sanctions because I believe that the conduct in this appeal has forced us to expend time and energy and effort we should not have had and has ignored this court's prior warnings about how to behave.
Thank you, Mr. Bankston. Mr. Brooks.
Thank you so much. I'm going to try to, so many things I would like to address here, but first of all, I guess to start,
Mr. Brooks, I'm just going to jump to cat busting right immediately. Two questions.
Yes.
How would you have tried your case differently had the pleadings been amended to add these cat busting? So that goes to the unfair surprise. And two, respond to the trial by consent argument on this cat busting.
Let me go to the second one first. Okay. This is a typical example of the conflation that's happened. Were the parents emotionally distressed and disturbed that anybody's child being murdered would obviously, I mean, I'm thinking about my grandbabies. I mean, that's the first thing you think about. This is 5 or 6, 7 years later about broadcast or talk about that. The statute that we're talking about does not say emotionally disturbed. It says a criminal statute that you become a disabled individual. That ain't the same thing as being emotionally upset or even traumatically emotionally upset.
Well, it's a crime against a disabled individual.
Right, exactly. But the statute, and I was struggling to get on the internet to bring up the criminal statute, but a disabled, I've done the research, I just couldn't access it. A disabled individual doesn't mean someone who is emotionally upset. Every case where emotional damages are entered, you have to be really, really, really emotionally upset. But that emotional distress is not the same thing as being a disabled individual.
Well, so there's something in the statute that defines, that allows that. A disabled person is also defined as somebody who has a severe, I mean, I believe it's quoted in your brief. A disabled individual, I believe, can also be somebody who has a severe emotional disturbance or a mental, behavioral, or emotional disorder.
Right. But I was trying to access my research and I couldn't. But that, what that means is if you take advantage of a mentally retarded person or someone who's got steal money from someone who can't protect themselves. That's what this statute is not. It's not designed to take the traditional emotional distress that the civil courts deal with and say, yeah, but you can get a cap budget. Heck, if that was the case, everybody would be. If your emotional distress was severe enough, you'd qualify as a disabled person. That's not the law, and that's not that statute, and it just can't be. Now, let me tell you, so that was not tried by consent. Were these people upset? Well, sure they were. There was a question as to whether the broadcast caused the problem versus the tragedy itself. But let me tell you, this is the thing that I think is so disturbing, because if you go
but
back...
But before you go there, she asked one other question. How would you have tried the case differently had it been pled before?
Boy, that's such an interesting question, because if I got parachuted in right in the middle of this and handed this situation and said, versus what I would have done from the get-go, Your Honor, I'm not prepared to answer that. I don't have any idea, but I tell you this much.
Fair.
I would not have gone down saying, yeah, we agree. It didn't happen here. We did not stipulate. I've read the record and I've talked to the lawyer. Nobody stipulated these people were statutorily disabled individuals. Didn't happen. Now, but I'm going to tell you, though, that I want to remind you of the Ratamco case, and I want to read you the section that I was talking about in Ratamco, because I was able to pull that up from my save files. In Ratamco, at the very end, the Court of Appeals, this is the Supreme Court, says, is talking about these civil practice agreements, code 41.00011A. This is, my thing says asterisk 255. And it says, punitive damages are intended to punish the wrongdoer. They nevertheless must bear some relationship to the liability producing conduct, citing the statute, requiring fact finder to consider the nature of the wrong, character of conduct involved, degree of culpability, and extent to which conduct offends public sense of justice. See also in the matter of Gober, parenthesis, noting that conduct sufficient to warrant punitive damages is not regarded as admitted by default. Now, that's the Texas Supreme Court citing the Fifth Circuit saying matters, conduct sufficient to warrant punitive damages is not regarded as admitted by default. Now, I don't know how the case could, that's Supreme Court. Now,
would you give us a cite to that? I'm looking at
Your Honor.
At
I'm.
Your
I'm it's. I was. I'm struggling for. I was trying to go online. My page says asterisk 25. I don't have the page. I'll give it by post trial. But I shall. But let me tell you this. This is the whole. This was the TCPA, and that this was the very thing we argued in this court. We got limited discovery in my case. Limited discovery for good cause. That's all he was supposed to get. TCPA discovery. That's it, not merits discovery. Judge Jenkins specifically said to this guy in these hearings, this isn't even merits discovery, this is TCPA discovery that you're not. And so what happens is that, and Judge Jenkins in one of these transcripts says, listen, Bankston, you asked for the moon, wasn't limited discovery, and I gave it to you. And now you're complaining about the volume, and he said, in Lewis, you're even using the information from Lewis to defend the TCPA. For him to say it was worthless, that's not true. Judge Jenkins said he had an extensive discussion about his use of the documents. He got the documents, 80,000. He asked, it wasn't limited discovery, but the point is it was TCPA discovery. That's all that was. And 2 months after this case comes back to the
mandate. And counsel, you'll need to be wrapping up.
Oh, I'm sorry, I apologize for that.
Sure.
Your Honor, there was no, under Rule 279, this was not submitted to the jury. And it should have been submitted to the jury. We think that the constitutional review with the appendices we provided you will be easier for this court to make. Thank you so much for your time and excellent questions.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Brooks, Mr. Bankston. The court's going to stand in recess, and this case is submitted. Thank you.